This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Why Things Bite Back, Technology and the Revenge of Unintended Consequences. Written by Edward Tenner. Narrated by Steve Kramer. Preface. This book began as it is ending, on paper. It started 10 years ago when I saw something curious happening as personal computers appeared on one desk after another at my office, an academic publishing house. Futurism was thriving. Its most successful practitioner, Alvin Toffler, had declared in his best-selling The Third Wave that, quote, making paper copies of anything is a primitive use of electronic word processing machines and violates their very spirit, unquote. Yet the paper recycling bins seemed always to be brimming with printouts. And even after the office was networked and electronic mail had replaced hard copy memos, the paper deluge continued. I was not around to see it, but a former colleague explained. People were using electronic mail, including the internet, in place of telephone calls. But they wisely did not trust the permanence of electronic records. Besides, many files circulated among 3 or 4 departments. Cryptic cross-references to electronic files would not do. Networking had actually multiplied paper use. When branches of Staples and Office Max opened near Princeton, the first items in the customer's view, and in the catalogs, were 5,000 sheet cases of paper for photocopiers, laser printers, and fax machines. Use of paper has continued to soar. It is as though paper is taking its revenge on the futurists. Not that any futurist has ever lost business because of a wrong prediction. And I wrote an essay titled The Paradoxical Proliferation of Paper that in turn made me look at the strange consequences of nearly everything, results that seem to contradict every reasonable scenario. Paper seemed to have an existence of its own that defied the human will to control it. Things seemed to be fighting back. Futurists had not reckoned with the perversity of ordinary objects and systems. Neither libertarians trusting in infallible market processes nor greens prophesying starvation and environmental collapse had imagined the real future, but it was also impossible to refute either point of view. For the first, hardships and disasters are mere challenges to a boundless human ingenuity. For the second, any gain in living standards is just another charge against a dread future reckoning. Humankind is either on its way to the stars or hurtling out of a high-rise window to the street and mumbling, "So far, so good." I am not trying to resolve this debate. The poet Paul Valéry was surely right when he wrote in 1944, "Unpredictability in every field is the result of the conquest of the whole of the present world by scientific power. This invasion by active knowledge tends to transform man's environment and man himself. To what extent, with what risks, what deviations from the basic conditions of existence and of the preservation of life, we simply do not know. Life has become, in short, the object of an experiment of which we can say only one thing, that it tends to estrange us more and more from what we were or what we think we are, and that it is leading us, we do not know, and can by no means imagine where." Valéry, in 1944, was evoking the errors that the best thinkers of 1890 would have made in trying to foresee the next 50 years. In fact, these errors were not just hypothetical. Valéry had no way of knowing it, but in the early 1890s, a U.S. newspaper syndicate had surveyed 74 eminent American men and women about life in 1893, and it published the results for the Chicago World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. Dave Walter has compiled their responses in a fascinating book, and they show the perils of technological extrapolation. What is remarkable is not any omission of nuclear weapons or microelectronics. Many public figures of the late 19th century foresaw both new weapons of mass destruction and new forms of electrically powered global communication. The striking oversight is the rise of mass motoring. Nobody understood the chain of technological, commercial, social and political events that would surround the internal combustion vehicle which Carl Benz had patented in 1886. For that matter, even the physics professors of Harvard a century ago failed to recognize the impending transformation of their own field. Their 1880s Jefferson Laboratory, still in use, was designed especially to advance the physics of the future, terrestrial magnetism. But then, as a wise musician once said, if I knew the jazz of the future, I'd play it. I do not know the jazz of the future either. This is not a book of prediction. It is a new look at the obvious. It is obvious that technology makes many things better. By technology, I mean humankind's modification of its biological and physical surroundings. It is also obvious that we are still unhappy about those surroundings, more discontented than when they were inferior. I consider four main areas: health and medicine, the environment, the office, and sports. I describe real technological gains in coping with human problems, but also the frustrations that have accompanied those gains. The technological dream of a self-correcting world is an illusion no less than John von Neumann's 1955 prediction of energy too cheap to meter by 1980. The social goal of a new Athens, of machine-supported leisure, has proved a noble mirage. Technology demands more, not less, human work to function. And it introduces more subtle and insidious problems to replace acute ones. Nor are the acute ones ever completely eliminated. In fact, unless we exercise constant care and alertness, they have a way of coming back with new strength. We are on a treadmill that we can no longer dismount from. We cannot turn back to a wholesome past, if only because the past, while sometimes more decorous, was far messier than we realize or perhaps can realize. A whole book could be written about mud, and another about dust. We are unhappy, I suggest, for two reasons. First, in controlling the catastrophic problems, we are exposing ourselves to more elusive chronic ones that are even harder to address. And second, our greater safety demands more and more vigilance. Occasionally, we really do simplify things. Programming a video cassette recorder was once an almost comic exercise. Now, ingenious mathematical routines built into the machines let us tape television shows by punching in a handful of numbers printed in the newspapers. Far more often, though, the apparent simplicity of technology conceals underlying problems that then become far more difficult to diagnose and treat, whether they are in automobiles or in personal computers. My experience leads me to doubt whether the electrical system of a car, once it starts to malfunction, can ever truly be repaired. And a stylish and even friendly computer interface may conceal a fatal tangle of corrupted files, not to mention latent bugs. Chronic problems, almost by definition, demand maintenance rather than solution, while the need for vigilance and care becomes itself a chronic irritation. I see no way around our predicament. Neither the quest for a Spartan, sustainable existence nor reliance on the forces of the marketplace will release us. I am writing not for policymakers, but for people stumbling through a Rube Goldberg world and trying to make sense of it. I am arguing not against change, but for a modest, tentative, and skeptical acceptance of it. An award from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation made this project possible. I am indebted to the foundation for its generosity, flexibility, and understanding. A grant from the Exxon Education Foundation for another project also enabled me to continue my career as an independent writer. Special thanks are due to the program officer who initiated the grant, Richard R. Johnson, and to the president of the foundation, Edward F. Onert. Years ago, William H. McNeill opened my eyes to new ways of bringing science and technology into history. Thomas P. Hughes and John McPhee also have given me indispensable encouragement. I began the project as a visitor in the School of Social Science at the Institute for Advanced Study. I am grateful to Joan W. Scott, executive officer at the time, and to the other faculty of the school for their patience and comments. Albert O. Hirschman of the School of Social Science and Freeman Dyson of the School of Natural Science were especially helpful. At the Rutgers Center for Historical Analysis, John R. Gillis and Victoria de Grazia introduced me to another vigorous academic community. And most recently, Robert O. Finney, John Suppy, and S. George Philander helped make my affiliation with the Department of Geological and Geophysical Sciences at Princeton University an equally productive one. Dozens of scientists, scholars, and government officials answered my questions patiently and responded generously to requests for reprints. I should single out a few for special thanks. In the Princeton and Rutgers communities, I had excellent counsel from Enoch Durbin, Freeman Dyson, Robert Frieden, Gerald L. Giesen, John R. Gillis, Stanley N. Katz, Jackson Lears, and Michael S. Mahoney. John T. Bethel and Christopher Reed of Harvard Magazine, Michelle Preston and later James I. Merritt III of the Princeton Alumni Weekly, and Jay Tolson and Stephen Lagerfeld of the Wilson Quarterly all encouraged me to develop the ideas that led to this project. Joseph W. Daubin's encyclopedic knowledge and superb editorial eye have helped me overcome many a hurdle. Barbara Frieden's enthusiasm for the project and her organizational skills made it possible to put in order the reams of research materials accumulated in this project. I have also learned much from conversations with Charles L. Creasy, Michael Volk, Russell C. Mollitz, M.D., Stephen S. Morse, Stephen J. Pine, Don C. Schmitz, Jesse Ausubel, Joseph Keller, J. Nadine Gelberg, and Daniel Hedrick. James Andrew Secord's inspired phrase, "Ever since Frankenstein," has become a chapter title with his kind permission. Because I have written this book for non-specialists and have only been able to touch on vast literatures like those of risk assessment, natural hazards, and conservation biology, it is especially important that none of these teachers, colleagues, friends, and consultants should be blamed for any error or omission. Ashbel Green's editorial guidance and encouragement, and the acumen and thoroughness of Alfred A. Knopf's production department have been invaluable. So has the understanding and skill of my literary agent, Peter L. Ginsburg, and his colleagues at Curtis Brown Limited. Edward Tenner, Princeton, New Jersey, May 1995.